I'm Heather Moran. I'm 45 years old. I'm here today, Friday, May 9th, 2014, at the Camden Public Library. And I'm here with Seth Silverton, who is a community member and a businessman, and we're just getting to know him.
My name is Seth Silverton. I'm 48 years old. Today's date is May the 9th, 2014. I'm in the Camden Public Library, and I'm with Heather Moran, who is my interviewer and a valuable member of the staff here at the Camden Public Library, also known as a Wisdom Center.
Thank you. So what would you like to talk about today, Seth?
I'd like to talk about our message as both my message and our community's message to our great-great-great-grandchildren and some of the things that we're doing now to set the preconditions for their successful future, or at this point what we'd consider a sustainable future.
That sounds fascinating. So what message would you like to give to them?
I'd like them to know that many of us are aware of the fact that the ecology doesn't look so good right now, that our economy is based on the availability of resources that have peaked and are no longer as readily available to us, that the actions of these two factors combined have done a great deal of damage to our environment, but that we are actively taking steps to make that better and to set the preconditions for their eventual success so that they don't have to worry about all the things that we've done to damage the environment. And I'd like to let them know that not all of us had our hands off the wheel, and some of us were responsible, and that the way to make this sustainable future for them happen is to connect with our community in healthy and nurturing and compassionate ways. So my job is to make that happen, to bring people together around the idea of sustainability.
So how do you do that? How do you bring those people together? What do you put out there as sort of the interest, the hook of getting them?
I think that, well, with my work, we have a number of different programs that address that directly. I started a program through my business, which is called the Wood Chop School. And one of the programs that we have is called Village Roots, where we work with suppliers of organic and locally grown foods so that we can get those foods to people who are at risk economically and wouldn't have access to them normally. Over the past 6 months, we've gotten $40,000 worth of organic and sustainably grown foods with our partner here in the mid-coast of Maine, Fresh Off the Farm and Albert's Organics as the distributor. Mm-hmm. So we've worked out strategic relationships where we deliver that food. I also have a business that is a consulting business where I go into businesses and help them achieve better working relationships in groups by addressing issues of food security and working groups through leadership and team building, and that's called the Modest Warrior Program. So all of my work is basically focused on bringing people together through access to not only healthier things that they put in their body, but also healthier decision-making within the group.
How did you come to this point in your life? Because you have a background in banking?
I was an investment banking professional in New York, on September 11th, my wife and I lived in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And that was a really terrible day for us. And we'd had a family history in this part of the world, in Maine, on the mid-coast of Maine. And we'd always dreamt about moving here. Mm-hmm. And so on September 11th, I turned to my wife, whose name is Jessica, and I said, you know what? I'm really tired of the two-hour commute, and now I'm tired of you know, all the stress of living in this environment. And this is really kind of the linchpin, the key event that made me decide to move my family here for a better quality of life. And that's something that, you know, I thought I knew a lot about this part of the world when I did that. But I've learned so much more about the importance of the mid-coast of Maine in terms of its position for our country as a sustainable source for the future. So my decision to move to this part of the world from, you know, from a nuts and bolts sustainability perspective was kind of a really, really happy coincidence. You know, there are two water-rich regions in the United States. One is the Pacific Northwest, and the other one is Maine.
Interesting.
Largely.
Right.
And water scarcity is a problem that our great-great-great-grandchildren will be dealing with, unfortunately, for a great deal of time because of the realities of climate change and what we've done to the environment. And so a great deal of my work, the reason that I have programs like Village Roots and my Modest Warrior program, which is my consulting business, my team building and leadership program, and the other work that we do, is to responsibly deal with the reality of the shift in resource availability and to create a generation of leaders here in Maine that can deal with the responsible stewardship of this most precious resource, which is fresh water.
How has the response been?
Oh,
that.
It's just been fantastic. It's been great. You know, every time I get up and I do a talk, whether it's a TEDx talk or a Pecha Kucha, or when I speak in front of a group of people, the phone just rings and rings and rings, and it's everything from people who are wanting to volunteer in one of our projects to people who are interested in having us come to their organizations to do team building and leadership work. And the response is really, aside from all the other reasons, that it's tremendously gratifying. It's gratifying because it brings people together in a really, really healthy way. And a lot of the kind of great sins of our age have to do with the disconnection that we have from one another.
Yes.
You know, we commute to work in cars, and we exist in cubicles, and we communicate via telephone. There's not a lot of personal interaction where we have experiential knowledge of other people. And a great deal of my work has to do with reconnecting human beings with each other and having, you know, people realize that establishing a village in whatever iteration that manifests itself in is really the only rational response to the challenges that we face. There are no magic bullets for peak oil.
Right.
We have a lot of people on the planet, as of this morning, you know, over 7 billion of us, and we don't have the fuel that got them all there and fed them and got them medicine. But that's the bad news. The good news is that this, you know, the absence of that, the moving away from that, as the foundation of our economy and the foundation of you know, everything that we have. Most of the things that I'm staring at in this room are made out of petroleum products. We have to figure out healthy ways in which to answer that, the lack of that substance. And so it's necessary for me to engage in this kind of work, and that resonates with people. And it just so happens that, you know, the mid-coast of Maine is and Maine in general, is where there's a tremendous migration of energy, human energy.
Creativity, too.
And creativity. There's a wonderful creative economy here. I also just coincidentally am on the board of directors of a local theater company. And had you asked me when I was, you know, in the investment banking world, you know, 10 years ago or years ago, whether I would be, you know, involved in the arts here, I'd say, no, of course not. That's absurd. But
Here you are.
Here I am. Hey, kids, let's put on a show. That kind
of
deal.
I'm curious about the demographics of what you're talking about. You're talking about connecting people to this idea of sustainability. Are you seeing more young people interested in it versus old, or how does that look to you?
Yeah, it's funny when I do a class. The irony is we're sitting in a room called the Pickering Room, mm-hmm. and the Camden Public Library, and I've actually done a class in this room, which is it's a great experience. But when I stood where I'm sitting now and looked out over the crowd, a lot of gray-haired people. And those are the people that have, first of all, the time to come out to
right.
do something like that. But those are the people that this message has resonance with, because, of course, many of them came to this part of the country, this part of the Northeast, as part of the Back to the Land movement. And that has some sort of commonality for them.
Right.
But when the phone rings, it's people from all over the community. I have young people that are interested in helping. I have people who are contemporaries of mine who would call and say, hey, listen, I am interested in starting a program where I take at-risk moms to the supermarket and show them how to shop, where I show them how to buy things that aren't corn syrup from Iowa, that are, you know, locally grown foods here, how to make that work within the budget, how to cook, how to use rice in a meal mm-hmm. to stretch, how to make better nutritional choices. And really, a good part of the work that we do is not only geared towards having a healthy impact emotionally, but also to have a healthy impact for state budgets that can't deal with extremely expensive healthcare costs into the future.
It's really flipping people's thinking, that cheaper is not always better. Locally sourced is healthy.
You can pay the doctor now, or you can pay the supermarket now, or you can pay the doctor later. But part of what we do, obviously, there's a migration towards, oh well, you probably work with a bunch of great chefs. We do, and that's part of the energy that happens around the sustainability movement. The farm to plate movement is a big mm-hmm. part of that. And the irony, the wonderful culture shock, is when you have the experience of getting somebody access to, somebody who, let's say a single mom who's financially at risk, who has an EBT card and who doesn't have a car and has to get lifts everywhere. When that person starts growing their own food or foraging for food, they end up with the same things on their plate as you would find in, James Beard Award-winning
restaurants.
and the difference between that ingredient being prepared for $30 a plate and that ingredient being prepared for free is knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so imparting that knowledge, taste is a big part of it, but also, experiential knowledge, it's a process of educating people.
Right.
And we like to target single moms because it's important to get them access to healthy information for their kids so that their kids can be part of this revolution. And that's why we kind of call ourselves food activists, because we're intentionally attacking the unsustainable at many, many different levels.
Right, right. And you do have a broad impact if you can affect the mom's thinking and show her how to cook, in a healthy manner, then that is just trickle down to the kids, and then they learn that and can pass it on.
It absolutely is. I'm reminded of the experience that I had when my daughter and son, who are now 18 and 15, my daughter having just gotten back from China, which is interesting, because the way that the Chinese eat is actually a good model for the way that we should eat. And that is to say, when you ask a Chinese person about the way Americans eat, they'll say, I saw this gigantic piece of beef on a plate, and that's what we use to feed an entire family of eight people,
Unreal.
And so it's that type of, consumption that we're trying to reprogram. Mm-hmm. However, the experience that my children had when they saw the movie Super Size Me. And I, you know, they were young. Mm-hmm. And an amazing thing happened. It was right around the time that we were kind of communing back and forth to New York to see relatives and stuff. And we heard so many fewer requests to stop at McDonald's, you know. And
that now and then. Movies had quite an impact. My son saw it as well, and he had the same reaction. I don't want to eat fast food anymore.
And so that's
a good thing.
And it's information.
Yes.
And it's also experiential knowledge. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between a generation of kids that suffers from cardiovascular disease and a generation of kids that has a different idea about food. Mm-hmm. So that is really what our business and our charitable work is really about. When we go into a business, we talk to people about the ways in which they interact with each other and how more connections within work groups around the model of a village, around the model of collaboration, is really the natural human way to process workflow. And that energy and those relationships are really similar to what happens within a traditional village, where people get together mm-hmm. and share information by stories and things like that, mm-hmm. and break down the barriers that typically separate them. And once you find that you're able to break down those barriers, you think about team building and leadership mm-hmm. as a bunch of executives that go out into the woods and shoot paintballs at each other, you know, or walk a confidence course. I question how effective that is. Mm-hmm. They go out and they get to spend a day out in the outdoors, and maybe one executive will be weaker than the others in this physical way and will get picked on or will be afraid to climb the confidence course. And then that will cause their... I've asked executives to describe to me what their team building and leadership experiences were like. And they say, well, you know, I noticed that partner X at the law firm was unable to conquer this part of the confidence course, and that really adversely affected his career. And so my reaction to that is that has nothing to do with his ability to communicate and do his job effectively within the workplace. And so the Modest Warrior, which is our program, is based upon collaborative and supportive and intuitive leadership, as opposed to a more Machiavellian, destructive way that the workplace sometimes can manifest itself. And so what we found is that people find it extremely beneficial mm-hmm. for work groups. And then what you have, you know, worst case scenario, you end up with an employee that has better decision-making processes, you know, for their own health, which has a positive impact on the company's bottom line
right.
in terms of healthcare costs.
Right.
What I also wanted to talk about was, you know, the trajectory of my family's history. You know, my great-grandfather, Julius, came from a town called Lodz in Poland. This is my mother's father's father. And he, with 15 other kids, trekked across Europe to escape the desperate poverty of what in the 1850s must have appeared to be dirt floors, cold, wet misery. Mm-hmm. And just at the part of the Industrial Revolution, I can imagine that word of America and how fantastic it was and the rest of Western Europe and the Industrial Revolution and what that had brought in terms of economic opportunity mm-hmm. was a magnet for these young men who were from 12 to 17 years old.
So he set out on his own or
on
with
foot?
On foot.
With 15 other kids. And their goal was to get to Holland.
Talk about courage, striking out on your own like that.
And he was apparently not a particularly easy man. Mm-hmm. But they made it. However, many of the people that started out with him died along the route, and they were taken by wolves and gypsies, apparently. This is the family history. So this is an oral history that my grandfather told me. Mm-hmm. And his father wasn't really a storyteller, you know, not exactly the most gregarious guy. So that's, you know, not the kind of thing that maybe he would have easily made up. Mm-hmm. He arrived in Holland, stowed away in a boat, got to Liverpool, where he met my great-grandmother. He got off the boat, got a job with a fishmonger, selling a wheelbarrow full of fish on the docks. And he took the wheelbarrow and the fish and sold the wheelbarrow and the fish and took off. And that's how he got his start in Liverpool. And my great-grandmother found him, and she was this elegant woman. And she said that he was this, you know, this beautiful Pole with these striking blue eyes. And she said that she married him. He was really nice. He was kind of like a tough guy. And she said that she married him because she wanted to have beautiful children. And and of course, that actually happened. They produced a son named Stanley. And Stanley was the great hope of that part of the family. They were called the Richlands or Reichlands, mm-hmm. Which was the family name. And Stanley came to this country and moved to Brooklyn. And because he was from England, he looked the wrong way when he was working one day and was struck dead by a streetcar.
Oh, my.
And the money that he had workers' insurance, and that money went back to England and made it possible for my mother's father's family to come over. And that's how all the kids came over to America. And so, you know, the story from the middle to late part of the 1800s, you know, to the early part of the 1920s, my grandfather got a job selling or flags and flagpoles was a big business in New York in those days.
Oh, my goodness.
And his job was to lug around flags and flagpoles for the, I think it's called the Annan Flag Company. They're still mm-hmm. in business. And one day he got a call from a relative or a cousin, and they said, well, there's a judge that needs an office boy. And, you know, we'd like you to go interview for this job. And he went up there, and he had unbelievably beautiful penmanship. And I still have some of his samples of his handwriting. I have his papers. And it was true. He did have unbelievably beautiful penmanship. And so that's how he got his job as the office boy for the chief prosecutor that prosecuted the Tammany Hall corruption. And he worked as the office boy, and then as an assistant for this judge. He passed the bar exam. He worked through city politics and became the lawyer for the city of New York during the 1970s, during
That's
the
incredible.
Fiscal crisis. And so from what I'd like to say to my great-great-great-grandchildren is that your relatives started out in Eastern Europe with dirt floors and desperation, and through their own efforts and luck and the economic opportunities that this country offered, were able to manifest really a great part of the American dream. And we, your great-great-great-grandparents, are working towards making the same type of opportunity available to you. And we don't know what the exact steps will be to make that happen. We understand that part of it is finding alternative energy sources. Part of it is fixing what's wrong with the ecology as best as we can. And part of it is coming together as a village so that we can work together and become leaders, as opposed to separated entities fighting each other. But that's what I really want to communicate to my great-great-grandchildren, is that there's a tangent, and if you follow the thread of your family's history and the history of this great part of the country, you'll see that we're thoughtful people, and we were educated, and we're thinking about you.
That is a wonderful, wonderful message to impart to your grandkids, great-grandkids.
And we try to, you know, share that message with people that we come in contact with, whether it's for profit or not for profit. Mm-hmm. Coming together in a community sharing, being compassionate, giving back to your community right. is something that's crucially, crucially important. And it's important to do it not just because it makes you feel good, but it's important to do it because we need to establish these human ties in order to have a successful future. And it's really the only answer to religious extremism and fundamentalism. It's the only answer to climate. It's the only answer to the economy. It's the only answer. And so that's our work. That's what we've dedicated ourselves to, is to bring people together. Not that we have an answer, but at least that sets the preconditions for whatever comes next.
You get people talking, and that's the key. We can't exist in a void. And so building that community, like you said, is really the key, the core to all of this.
And so what happens next when these people begin talking, when these people begin engaging with each other, is things start to magically happen. I was also, I gave a speech 2 months ago in which I talked about amazing transformation that the World War II generation went through in this country. And specifically, one of the great events was the migration of an energy. And the energy that I'm talking about here is what happened when all of the workforce that was in the manufacturing sector in this country, it was largely white, it was largely male, and that was the trained workforce. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. When that workforce went off to Europe to fight fascism and went to the Pacific to fight fascism, there was a void. And that void in the manufacturing sector was filled by people who didn't have those skills before. And those people were women. And we all know the story of Rosie the Riveter, or at least if we don't know the story of Rosie the Riveter, we should know the story of Rosie the Riveter. And African-Americans from the South. And those two groups of people moved to the industrial manufacturing sectors of the Northeast. It was responsible for the last great socio-demographic shift in our country's history. And they got skills. And they got experiential knowledge of real economic empowerment. And real economic empowerment changed the narrative of those two groups for the rest of time. It set the preconditions for the equal rights movement. Mm-hmm. It set the preconditions for the civil rights movement. And it's just because there was an energy vacuum that was filled with a different kind of energy.
Right.
Now, because of resource scarcity, because of water scarcity in other parts of the United States, there's an energy vacuum here. We have water here in Maine. We have fresh water here in Maine. And we don't have fresh water in population centers in other parts of the country. In California, in Arizona, in Florida, and in the center of our country, our agricultural sector is largely supported by a body of water, which is aquifer, which is a subterranean source of water called the Ogallala Aquifer. It was named for the Ogallala Sioux Indian Tribe, which is a branch of the Lakota Sioux Indian Tribe, for Ogallala, Nebraska, which, by the way, is not what the Native Americans called it. And it's in tremendous decline. So there is a flow of human energy to this part of the world, and it's basically following the water. Water equals food. Water equals energy. Water equals economic progress. Water equals life. Mm-hmm. And so what you see now is all of this innovation starting to take place in this part of the world, despite some of the challenges that we face, despite the fact that we have a very challenging economy that this has to coincide with. Mm-hmm. Our work at Woodchop School and our work through Village Roots is meant to set the preconditions for making that energy a positive thing, or using that energy in a positive way. And much of it just seems to happen effortlessly. You know, if there's a need, the phone will ring. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's part of the energy too. Wonderful synchronicities that happen from time to time.
What would you say to the young people here in Maine? Would you encourage them to stay in this area? Because we do have a challenged economy here.
We have a brain drain. And what I would say is that you can leave. You can find your way in other parts of the country. But most of you will come back. And you'll come back because as you grow older, entirely apart from the fact that we have a burgeoning and very hopeful economy in this part of the world, and we'll almost, it's almost axiomatically true that it necessarily has to be the economic leader of this part of the world, Maine, that is to say. It seems like an absurd statement to make, and I understand that it does. But there are very few other places in the world where the most compelling economic asset exists and is not an affluent area. Mm-hmm. So my message to my kids, which they've heard, and hopefully one day their kids and their kids and their kids, is going to be that this is the part of the world where it's all happening. And you're starting to see people who are thoughtful, people who are forward-thinking, mm-hmm. all migrating to this part of the world for no other reason than they're following the energy that leads here. And so all we're doing is tapping into that energy mm-hmm. as part of our work. I think, you know, if I can talk about storytelling for a second.
Sure.
Storytelling to me is to the entertainment world as local foods and farm to table is to the food world. It's part of the localization of all things. Stories are a very human way of interacting. They have a resonance. And every time that I've given a speech or told a story in front of a group in any form, their group has been sold out. Not because of me. I'm not saying that because of me. What I'm saying is that storytelling is a very compelling thing. And you see stories on StoryCorps, and you see stories on the Moth Radio Hour. It's extremely popular stuff. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because it's kind of like, and if you asked me what was going to be happening in the future, I think people will augment going to the movies with going out to hear stories. And so we're working to make that happen. We're starting a storytelling series, which will be involved with eating out. It'll be a night of eating out and storytelling under one roof. And when you think about it, that is the most ancient human construct that you can get.
You're right.
When a village comes together, they do two things. They eat, and they want to tell stories.
Right.
And so we're working on making that happen.
And I think through the storytelling, you know, you really do establish the roots of the community. People can connect with that. They can see, you know, where they came from, and I think have a greater appreciation for, you know, each other, the community members, and where we're going.
And what does it do? It's an economic driver.
Right.
People become aware of what's happening in other parts of their community.
Right.
It's a way in which people can stop thinking of their neighbors as dangerous, mm-hmm. stop thinking of strangers as dangerous, and start thinking of situations instead. Mm-hmm. When everything is dangerous to you, you shut yourself off and you freeze your process. It's what happens when we judge. When we judge, we basically freeze our process. We no longer progress as human beings. Mm-hmm. Storytelling in villages is a way to continue that process. And all that's happened over the past few decades mm-hmm. is a disconnection from that. And I'm not blaming any particular part of the way in which we communicate. I'm not blaming the internet. I'm not blaming television. It just happened.
Right.
And now we're coming back together again intentionally.
Mm-hmm. That's such a great thing. So, was there anything else that you would like to communicate to your descendants?
Well, I'm almost naturally opposed to leaving any time on the table whatsoever. So, I think that it's important to just know that, speaking to my great-great-great-grandchildren, it's important to know that all of the wonderful things that you're currently enjoying now as you sift through the cobwebs in the Library of Congress, well, hopefully Library of Congress won't be covered in cobwebs by the time you're listening to this, but it was my intention that I reach out over the course of two centuries to you and tell you that your great, 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 great grandfather was a guy that walked across Europe, and that you possess that same DNA code of bravery and adventure and discovery, and that you should act as boldly as you possibly can to set the preconditions for your great-great-great-grandchildren to have a successful and sustainable future. And that while we're aware of the fact that this is possibly the most challenging, or we're on the verge of the most challenging period in human history, where we don't have the energy or the ability to feed and clothe and house 7.5 billion people, we're working very, very hard to make whatever happens in our future one that is at least sustainable for you. So it's at once challenging, this period in time, but it's also extremely optimistic. And that is that we're disengaging from everything that was unsustainable, and we're reaching out and embracing that which is that which can keep you happy and healthy and living all of your dreams the way you want to live them. And that would be my message to my great-great-great-grandchildren. Also, to tell stories. If you're not telling stories, shame on you. Also, if a kid looks at you and smiles, it's your job to look back at that kid and smile and say hello. Those are rules you have to follow.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing, Seth.
You're welcome.
Incredible message.
Thank you.